honest people honestly lose elections. And when an election is held fairly and you lose the election, you submit to the rule. That's the game. That's how it's played. Those are the rules. Those are the rules. When you start changing the rules, when you start selectively enforcing the rules, or when you start doing any number of other things, then don't be surprised if the other team starts committing fouls where they weren't committing fouls before, because this is not something that is going to end well for you. And Mr. Unimpeachable here has been a magnet for people who have felt that their government no longer belongs to them. And the one thing his presidency accomplished more than any other, more than the economic recovery, more than the initial enormous setback to China's plans for hegemony around the world, forget about the number of record-setting historical peace agreements he's brokered in the Middle East. Of all of the things that Donald Trump's presidency accomplished, at least his first presidency, is that it has shown us just how committed progressive politicians, large numbers of the Democratic Party, I'm talking about party officials, big tech, the news media, entertainment, Hollywood, all of them, how openly disdainful they are of the idea of governance by the people, how openly disdainful they are of the idea of people making up their minds, how they brag in Time magazine about the ways that they managed to secure the country from the people having their own say. I would just strongly recommend that you do a little research on a woman named Marie Antoinette. That would be my final advice to you in the wake of Donald Trump's historic second victory. The unimpeachable president has now acquitted himself twice. The people who voted for him have acquitted themselves twice. The people who brought about these sham proceedings disgraced themselves, and then they disgraced themselves again. And that's the outcome of all of this. And now impeachment's a joke. The reason that we've heard the term white supremacist suddenly appear is because racist, that kind of go-to A-bomb, has been used so often that even the left understands that it has no meaning anymore. Even the left understands that everything is racist and everybody's been called racist, and there's nobody in the country who's not racist. And when you get down to the last of the crocodiles in the swamp, if you were to take all of the white people away from society, the people who are driving this ideology would then start circling each other and tearing each other up and starting to see which one of them was in fact the most virtuous, which one of them had the most boxes ticked off in terms of their victimhood status. And this isn't a joke. You know what this is? This is black supremacy. It really is. Because what it is saying is that if you are born white, you are intrinsically evil. And if you're a POC, person of color, then you're automatically good. If you have a racial theory that believes that one group of people, based on their skin color, is inherently evil, and another group of people, based on their skin color, is inherently good, then that is the by God living definition of racism. And so, I call it black supremacy because that's basically what it is. It's a power grab, and it is a form of parasitism. These people are parasites on your sense of decency and fairness. They are using events that happened seven generations ago to control you and to gain not only political power, but also to gain money and prestige and all the other things that people usually have to work hard for. That's what this is. It's an extortion game. Nice conscience you got there. Be ashamed if something happened to it. And this is how it works. And so you really do have to understand the mechanics of this kind of nonsense, because it's not really nonsense. It's carefully targeted psychological propaganda. And while people like you and I can read these things and just laugh out loud at how silly they are and how contradictory and how evil they are, there's large numbers of people who take this very, very seriously, who've been utterly brainwashed into this belief. He wasn't just a giant. He was our giant. He was our giant. Finally, for once, the regular people of America, the patriots who go to work every day in the morning, the people without any glamour or tremendous wealth or houses overlooking the ocean, he was a voice for all of us, and he was so damn good at what he did that I wouldn't have traded him for anybody, not for a living soul. He was our giant, and the best way we can honor his memory is do everything that we can within our power to return America to the kind of country he would be proud of, and most of all, to realize that of all the arguments he ever made, the one that we should remember forever is that the enemies of freedom are constantly, perpetually trying to demoralize us, to get us to give up, to get us to despair, and to get us out of the fight. I never once heard him feel sorry for himself or for us or for anything else. And that's what I'm going to take with me from Mr. Limbaugh. Next time I feel like I'm filled with despair and I don't know any way out of this situation and watching things just slide away, I'm just going to remember what our giant was and what he stood for and how the idea of being sad and filled with despair is okay, so long as you get up the next day. And that's what he did day after day after day. He got up, drove to work, sat behind that golden microphone, and saved the country. So we end up with things like Harvard University students demanding that Harvard University revoke the degrees of people that they don't like. Anything they see that offends them, and everything offends them. And why wouldn't it? If you've grown up to believe that anytime anybody says anything offensive to you, that is a direct assault on you, that you've never learned in childhood how to deal with names and teasing and bullying and taunting, if no one ever told you sticks and stones will break my bones but names will never hurt me, if you never got that actually in the head, then as time goes on, you grow more and more outraged, more and more sensitive, more and more desperate, more and more fragile, more and more delicate, and you become a monster because everything offends you. It's all you can do. It's all you know how to do. You are an offense-generating machine, and that's not the fault of the kids. That's the fault of the adults. My reaction to all this is when students demand that Ted Cruz be stripped of his degrees, my general reaction is to say, or what? If we don't do it, what's the consequences? You demand it. What if I say no? What if I say no? They don't know how to answer that. And the reason they don't know how to answer that is because they've never encountered that situation before. They've never encountered anybody saying no to them, ever. If they demand something, it happens. And what appears to be the most ironic part of this is that the teachers who created this entitlement attitude that had been basically fertilized, bred, and nurtured in the kids by their parents are the first ones to feel the results of this generation of delicate monsters that they themselves have created. It's the teachers who are the most afraid of these students, these social justice warriors. They're the ones that have to deal with them on a daily basis. I can happily ignore them because I never encounter them. And if I do encounter them, then I happily ignore them to their face. You know why? Well, because they're going to call me a racist and a misogynist and a homophobe and Islamophobe and all the rest. And I look at them and I think to myself, sticks and stones may break my bones, but names will never hurt me. So when you're used to making demands, and when your demands are always met, then you're going to make more demands, aren't you?